It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfhard. On today's show, we're saying happy birthday to the National Parks. This today is the 100th anniversary of the creation of the National Park Service, unless you're listening to us on a rerun. And that's the agency that takes care of some of the nation's most dramatic and valuable wilderness. We'll hear about that history and how the centennial is being celebrated. But our main emphasis today is on the parks themselves. Well, for this whole hour, we're going to have two guests in the studio who I'm really excited to talk about because they're two of the best outdoors folks and adventurers and people who have really done some cool stuff in Alaska. And they love the national parks and have explored them on a level that probably very few other people have done. Roman Dial is well known to our listeners, an APU professor of biology and mathematics. Thanks for being here, Roman.
Pleasure.
Yeah, probably better known for your math than for your mathematical exploits, for your pack rafting and exploring and being reality TV and everything else. And Brad Micklejohn, who is this state director of the Conservation Fund and just recently won the Murray Award from the Alaska Conservation Foundation and also a pack rafter and has done some fairly gnarly trips. Thanks for being here, Brad.
It's a pleasure to be here, Charles.
So, Roman, this show was your idea. It's 100th anniversary of the parks, and you obviously love the parks. And at some point you decided you wanted to explore all of them in Alaska, right?
Well, you know, it basically started in the late 70s when I was a teenager, and I did a solo trip across Denali National Park. I walked, you know, from the park road over Anderson Pass to the highway, to the, you know, park's highway, And then Jimmy Carter came along and using the Antiquities Act, he created, you know, well, he essentially doubled the size of America's national park acreage.
Right.
And I had seen, you know, Audubon and Sierra Club publications that were talking about the parks that were going to be created, like the Arrogetch, like the Wrangell St. Elias. And that really captured my imagination. And after that walk across that short walk, a three-day walk across Denali, I thought, wow, I want to visit all the parks, and I want to walk, and I want to cross them all, you know. And back then, there were no pack rafts, but a few years later, the pack rafts came out, and I was able to start to realize that dream.
So, but you are still working on it?
I'm still working on it, yep. There's 14, I guess, really, there's 15 parks if you count the Sitka Historical Park, but there's
that one's pretty easy to cross.
We've done that one, yeah.
But the other 14, you know, there's, I guess there's five up in the Arctic. You know, there's the Gates of the Arctic, there's the Noatak, there's Kobuk, Cape Krusenstern, and Bering Land Bridge, and those are the wildest ones. Mm-hmm. And then in the interior, there's Yukon Charlie, and there's Denali. Mm-hmm. And then in South Central, there's the Wrangell St. Elias, Kenai Fjords, Lake Clark. And then in Southwest, there's Katmai and Aniakchak. And then in Southeast, there's Glacier Bay and then the Klondike Historical Park,
right.
Which has the Chilkoot Trail.
Right.
So among those 14 parks, I've crossed them all from, you know, on their longest axis, except for Bering Land Bridge, Cape Krusenstern. And I've only done a little bit in Katmai. I haven't crossed the whole park. But with the advent of pack rafts, it allowed us, you know, to really explore these places.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of these parks, like, hardly anybody ever goes there. Mm-hmm. Bering Land Bridge being one that folks run around on snow machines there in the wintertime. But in terms of, like, outdoors people doing their traditional national park thing, there isn't even an office. There's no... You can't even drive to it, right? You have to walk across.
They say that Aniakchak is the least visited park in the country. Yeah, and I would say that the visitation that has happened and is taking place there now is largely because of pack rafts. I mean, you would be hard-pressed to visit Aniakchak and do more than touch down if you didn't have a pack raft. But with a pack raft, you can have an incredible trip from the Bering Seaside of the Alaska Peninsula all the way across to the Pacific side through the caldera down the Aniakchak River. And it's one of the best trips in Alaska, and pack rafts make that
possible. So I want to hear more. And this is like an outdoor explorer exclusive. Everybody's covering Yosemite and Yellowstone, right? We're covering Aniakchak. So tell me about the park. Where is it and what are the qualities of it, Brad?
Yeah, Aniakchak is a pretty far-flung park unit. It's about midway out on the Alaska Peninsula. Mm-hmm. It's one of the largest volcanoes on the kind of ring of fire chain. The center feature of the park is this extinct caldera. I think it's about 6 miles across. And what's amazing about that park is the walking. The walking is like a golf course. It's
really?
This low Crowberry, and it's super good walking.
Now, lichens are kind of like that in a lot of places.
In a lot of places, yeah. And you come to the edge of this six-mile-wide caldera, and you wind your way down through this little crack in the rocks down into the bottom of this caldera that's got all these little bubbling hot pots.
And it's like a moonscape when you look out across it. There's all these sub-craters within the main caldera and these kind of big lava bubbles, if you will, or like heaved areas and multiple colors, and then there's glaciers on it. It's amazing.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah, and there's a lake down in the bottom of it called Surprise Lake, and there's a river called the Aniakchak River which cuts out through the gates of the Aniakchak, kind of a slice through the side of the caldera, and then flows out down through the Bears and out to the Pacific side of the ocean. Roman and a big group of us did a trip out there. We called it Freezing Man, kind of a takeoff from Burning Man. There was a group of, 15 of us, Roman?
Yeah,
they kind of all had slightly different itineraries, and we'd meet up in different places along the route and finally finish that trip in the Chignecks. It was one of the best trips I've ever been on.
Wow. So no crowding in the end. Yeah.
Well, no, and when you do have a crowd, it's your own crowd,
right?
You know, and you're attracted to it instead of repulsed.
Well, when you look around at this, and you're a conservationist and work in that field, Brad, I mean, you must go to a place like that and say, yeah, this should be a national park. I mean,
my hat's off to the people who created these parks. They thought big, and it was an audacious dream. I mean, you look at the scale of our parks compared to anywhere in the world, and they got it right. I mean, Roman and I were recently on a trip going from the Noatak over to the Kobuk, and you're floating down the Kobuk, and you're realizing they captured the entire watershed of the Kobuk just about within this national park, and that's really unusual. It's almost like capturing the entire watershed of the Mississippi.
Yeah.
And so, you know, talk about ecosystem preservation. They did it right at that scale.
Right. Well, are there any of these parks on the flip side where you'd say, well, that's nice, but there are lots of other places that are just as nice in Alaska?
You know, the only one I would say that about, and I'll probably, I'll probably get in trouble saying it, is I'm not all that excited about Lake Clark. I mean, it's, along the whole length of the Alaska range, you know, Lake Clark is, I mean, you could have made that park north of it, and it would be about the same. Mm-hmm. It would be the Hayes Range south of Fairbanks, I think, is, you know, maybe just as beautiful. There are a bunch of neat lakes in the Lake Clark area, but I'm not as impressed by that one as I am by, you know, Denali or Wrangell-St. Elias or Gates of the Arctic. I mean, those things are world class. I mean, I've traveled the world looking for the best wilderness travel, and I still haven't been able to find better wilderness travel, meaning good travel with beautiful scenery, and than in Alaska. But, you know, Lake Clark is just,
It's funny, you hear people say that any other place, Chugach Park would be a national park.
It would, yeah. It's a very similar to Rocky Mountain National Park.
Yeah.
So, you know, and Denali National Park, the crown jewel, it's incredibly beautiful, you know, incredible numbers of people go there. This summer, I had the occasion to drive the Richardson Highway through the Alaska Range and go along, you know, Summit Lake there. And that is one of the most beautiful vistas in Alaska. It's unbelievable. It's got a paved highway, and you could sit on the road for 10 minutes and nobody ever comes along, right? Mm-hmm. And so there is this sense that by saying that Denali is the place you go, you get buses, and maybe that's good, you know, send all the buses to one place. But you spread out along the Alaska Range, and it's all unbelievable. I mean, it's just huge areas that are fabulous.
Yeah, I tend to think of the Denali Highway as the other Denali National Park.
Yeah.
And you can have a very similar experience along the Denali Highway as opposed to going into the park and dealing with permits and the buses and all that. And the Denali Highway is incredibly wild and relatively unvisited.
Although the park, I have to say, I hadn't been up there in a while, and maybe people avoid it a little bit because there are so many tourists, but they've really done a nice job of it doesn't have that Glitter Gulch feel that it used to. It feels a little bit more put together, and they've built a really nice visitor center and that kind of thing. I guess you guys probably don't hang out too much in the visitor center.
as little time as possible. Yeah. In fact, my feeling about Denali is it really starts beyond Wonder Lake. Mm-hmm. You know, that is a classic, world classic wilderness trip, is to go from Wonder Lake along the base of the Alaska Range and over to, say, like Rainy Pass, where you can, you know, fly out easily.
Can you do that walking? I mean, what? How do
yep,
you, how
walking
do you do it?
Or
like in the
pack
summertime?
Rafting. Yep, you need a pack raft to cross the rivers. I mean, I do. You know, because you have to cross like the McKinley River and walk up the Muddy River, and then there's a whole bunch of, you know, rivers draining the glaciers that come off Foraker and Denali. You got to cross, and the Tanzona River, and then if you're like you know, really feeling spicy, you can hike over and to the Happy River, and now you're out of the park, but float the Happy River down to Squintna. But I mean, that's world-class wilderness, and it's a really amazing ecosystem full of it's basically in some ways the wildest place in Alaska because it hasn't been hunted for over 100 years.
Right.
You know, there's no other place. I mean, there's a lot of places that are farther from roads or towns in Alaska than that part of Denali, but they've been hunted. People fly in, you know, snow machines bring native people in, but that stretch untouched. You don't even see an axe cut. You don't see like a cabin, and the animal trails are amazing.
Yeah. I want to ask you about hiking some of this terrain because, I mean, I love hiking in Denali, sort of in the tundra, like Gates of the Arctic, like fabulous hiking where you don't have to deal too much with willows and alders and that kind of stuff. But when you talk about crossing, you know, being in the 40-mile country and, you know, Yukon-Charlie River, it seems to me like that is just all mosquitoes and sort of brush and bugs. And that does not sound like a lot of fun. You've crossed that one, though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, after a while, you learn when the bugs are and when they're not. I mean, the best time to go to any of these places is between the snow and the mosquitoes, in right. my opinion. Because I don't, you know, I used to do ski trips, too, but I don't do ski trips anymore. And I like summertime. So early June, you know, I shouldn't tell anybody, but, you know, like June's the best.
Yeah.
And then August, July's the worst. And so July, from my perspective, is the time that you go to like the coast or you do a big river trip. You just stay out of the bushes and the bugs. But as far as bushes go, I mean, you know, I've been doing this stuff for, I don't know, maybe like almost 40 years now, I think. And
bushes don't bother you.
Well, they do.
They're getting worse. They're bothering us more. There's no question.
They really are.
We're getting shorter, I think. And the bushes are getting taller.
And they're getting, and those birches, the resin birches are growing up, and they're horrible. You know, like they're in the Alaska Range, they used to be like maybe shin high, and now they're like waist high, and they have those glands on them that secrete this papaviferic acid. It's like a sugar or salt crystal on it, and it'll wear your shoes out. You can't hike in it barefoot, and not barefoot but bare-legged, and it interlocks like this. It's really hard to push through, and it's just growing higher and higher. But I wanted to say, though, that, you know, I appreciate wilderness more than trail hiking, you know, because trails get to be kind of boring. I mean, I love finding a trail, but I really like looking for animal trails. And that's what makes Alaska really better than most other places, especially in South America or Australia, is that the animal trails are amazing when you can find them. And it's a real challenge to find them. And they're the ways through the brush.
Mm-hmm. And as your listeners will remember, if they've heard other shows that Roman's been on, he's the master of finding animal trails. There's really nobody better.
Well, I remember you saying, like, oh, I never walk in streams. That's for losers.
And he talks about the BMW trails, which are bear, moose, wolf trails. Uh-huh. And he has a nose for finding those like nobody else. And you should add C on that, because the caribou trails are the best if you can get on caribou trails, because caribou don't like to bushwhack. They have light horns. They're a lighter-bodied animal than a moose, and they don't like to fight their way through brush. And that's one of the changes that we're seeing, is the increase in brush is going to have a big impact on caribou, not only on their movement but on what they're foraging on. Because, you know, just behind my house here, I live up on Highland Road and Eagle River, the blueberry patches are getting overtaken by the willows and the birch. And clearly that's going to, you know, have a big impact on grazing animals, you know, like caribou, that are looking for the lichens they can't get to because of the birch.
Just huge change. Yeah. Let me tell everybody, it's Outdoor Explorer. We are talking today about the national parks having their 100th anniversary. And to do that, we've got two guys who have spent an enormous amount of time in the national parks talking about sort of the backcountry. We're not talking too much about the visitor centers or the nature trails. We're talking about like the smashing your way through the willows. And Roman Dial's done a lot of that over the last 40 years. He's an APU professor. And Brad Mickeljohn is with us. He's state director of the Conservation Fund, and also very involved in the American Pack Rafting Association. And my name is Charles Wolforth. This is our topic for the whole hour, so stay with us. I'm interested in some of the more challenging trips you've done. You know, Wrangell-St. Elias is so amazingly huge and so beautiful and so overwhelming, but a lot is, you know, I don't know, maybe there's roots there that make it not too difficult, but what are some of the most difficult and challenging trips you guys have done?
Well, you know, one of the classic routes in Wrangell-St. Elias is from Nabesda to McCarthy, and that's become somewhat of a trade route. It's a fantastic route. It's probably a good week-long trip for most folks, mm-hmm. and it was one of the routes for the Wilderness Classic for a number of years. But it encompasses lots of great variables along the way. You've got glacier crossing. You've got major rivers. You've got some challenging whitewater to paddle, big rivers to cross. So, I, you know, that's one of my
don't
favorite kind of classic.
For that one, too.
What's that? That's right. You can drive to the beginning and to the takeout on that trip. So that's a tremendous classic traverse of a national park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as far as, like, challenging ones, I'd say a really challenging one is to start in McCarthy and then go to Cordova, but not the usual way. The usual way would be to go down the Kennecott to the Nazina to the Chitna right. to the Copper. And that's a great boat trip. I mean, that's a world-class boat trip.
10-day, 2-week float trip, right?
Yeah, if you take your time. But a pack rafting trip, because the best pack rafting trips are not just a big boat trip, but it's where right. you can hike and boat, hike and boat, hike and boat. And so a really wonderful pack rafting trip, which is very challenging, though, is to float down the Kennecott, the Nazina, and the Chitna, and then climb out of the Chitna River near, I think it's called like Nelson Mountain, which is where a big landslide has come down and pushed through all the beetle kill and burned out spruce that fills the Chitna Valley. So mm-hmm. you don't have to stumble through that. Then you climb up over the shoulder of the mountain and then float a series of creeks and hike over a series of passes, working your way to the T-Bay Lakes. Mm. And the T-Bay Lakes are a beautiful chain of lakes. And then you drop into the Little Bremner. And the Little Bremner feeds into the Bremner, and that is really challenging brush. I mean, that's the kind of place where, you know, you go maybe 2 miles in a day. Mm. And it rains, and it's full of Devil's Club and alders, and it's steep, and it's got a bunch of those, you know, pickup sticks, you know, these beetle-killed spruce.
Miserable, right?
Yeah, miserable. And then you get into the Little Bremner River, and you think it's going to be an easy float out, but it's like 6 mile, you know, here. And you're like, oh, I better get out. And when we went down, nobody had floated it before, so we didn't know what we were really getting into. I was with a group of APU students at the time.
Oh, wow.
And then you get to the Bremner, and you think, oh, everything's great, but the Bremner is, you know, like, you know, 3 miles wide and 3 inches deep in places.
Oh, wow.
And then you try to get out of your boat and walk, and then you're in quicksand up to your knee.
Oh, great.
So, so then you have to walk across the Bremner Dunes, which are beautiful and amazing,
wow.
and put into the Copper. And then the Copper has its own problems, as you probably know. It can have upwind, upstream headwinds during the day. Or when you get past the Miles and Childs Glacier, down to Miles and Childs Glacier, there's a lot of ice in the river.
Mm-hmm.
That can block progress or, you know, create obstacles of its own when there's an...
Yeah, those huge, you know, break-off events with big waves and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And then you know, the Copper opens up into a bunch of channels and it's moving. And so, you know, the guidebooks say to go here or there, but that doesn't work anymore.
Right.
You have to go a different place. So I feel like, you know, that was a challenging route. The Wilderness Classic a few years ago, Luke Melp put on a route that he'd never done before that he thought would be a great route, and that went from Thompson Pass to near McCarthy, and that was like the absolute, so it went through the park. That mm-hmm. was, as far as I can tell, that was just probably the worst, slowest brush of my
brutal,
life.
Huh?
Oh my God, yeah. And I told him, we went to the meeting, I said, you know, hey Luke, yeah, this 12 miles right here, it's going to take 24 hours. And he just looked at me like I didn't know what I was talking about, but he didn't say anything,
uh-huh.
but that's what it took, you know?
I think part of the reason Roman has a dim view of Lake Clark National Park is because of a trip we did last year in 2015 with Mike Curiak, and it was my idea, so I'll take all the responsibility for it and the credit. We started in Port Allsworth and sailed our way, and lashed our pack rafts together and sailed across Contrashebuna Lake, which was pretty novel.
Awesome.
These guys didn't think it could be done. And then spent 2 days going through probably some of the worst brush. I would say maybe on par with the Bremner area, all the classic F-sticks, all the jackstraw, dead timber, dead alder. That
those
was a
alders,
new one for us.
Yeah,
we'd like, never seen dead alder.
Like
that
jail
was like, like fighting through barbed wire. But, you know, the cherry on top was getting to do a first descent of the Pyle River, beautiful river, and finishing on the east end of Lake Iliamna and paddling through the islands and seeing the seal. So it had, you know, to me it has a lot of you know great memories, but it did have some tough times along
so
the way.
So these are the seals that you just recently were able to participate in preserving.
Yeah, there's a rare population of freshwater seals that live at the east end of Lake Iliamna around a collection of islands, about 173 different islands, and the seals just live on all the abundant fish that that are coming into Iliamna from the Quijac River. So it's a fun project, and it's often my excuse to get out and see the country. Is I have a project there, and I got to go check it out. So
you've got a great job in that way.
Yeah, I make the most of it. I want to talk about a trip that I think Roman and I both agree is perhaps one of the best trips in Alaska is the Lost Coast trip. And there's two segments of it. We each just tried to do the northern part from Cordova
Define where we're talking.
Yeah, so basically Lost Coast goes from Cordova all the way down to Gustavus. Mm-hmm. And typically that's broken up into two pieces. Northern part would be from Cordova to Yakutat. Southern part would be from Yakutat to Gustavus. And I did the southern part last year and just thought it was one of the most interesting trips, a lot of interesting history, great rivers, challenging walking, interesting features, lots
of wildlife.
Do you
mostly walk along the shore then?
Walking along the beaches.
And then you hop in your pack raft to get
across the rivers. And there's dozens of challenging rivers to cross. You go through Lituya Bay, which has its own interesting history. Yeah. And then
Don't you run into spots where you have cliffs that fall straight into the ocean?
Absolutely you do. And we got super lucky because the last 90 miles of the trip or so is all either, you know, skirting these cliffs or getting in your boat and pack rafting. And we were able to go 90 miles in our last 3 days because we had flat, calm weather and good tailwinds for sailing our pack rafts. But these guys had bikes when they did it. And maybe you want to talk about what that experience was like for you guys.
Yeah, the fat bike. Yeah. I mean, I love taking a bike in wilderness. Let me make a distinction between backcountry and wilderness. So backcountry, that's Chugach State Park. And backcountry, to my way of thinking, has trails. Wilderness has no trails. And so what I'm really excited about in Alaska is Alaskan wilderness, i.e. places without trails. And so, you know, back in the 90s and late 80s, I did a lot of wilderness bike riding, and it wasn't very popular among anybody else. But now with the fat bike, it's great, and people have been riding their bikes on beaches, and Eric Parsons and Dylan Kench, they went from Yakutat all the way to Cordova with fat bikes, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been longer than that, 8 years ago. And so we got together with them and we did the trip that Brad just described going south from Yakutat. So like beach walking, I mean, it's great for about an hour, you know? And then it's like, okay, yeah, I got this.
You get bored?
And your feet hurt, you know, it's always at the same angle. It hurts my knees. I get a blister walking on a beach in about 20 minutes, you know? And so I love beaches, but I don't like walking them. And this riding sounded pretty cool. And there's amazing beaches there. But then, as Brad
completely
described,
with no one ever there.
With no one ever there. And then the beaches run out, and a glacier pushes into the beach, and we had to get out in the water and put
your bike
bikes.
in the boat.
Yeah, and go out around the glacier, and you know, make a surf take off in the surf and land in the surf. And
it must be hell on your bike to get all that water. Right?
That's, you know, a lot of these guys, they just, that's what they say. But I bring my bike home and I clean it up. And while I'm there, I take care of it. I rinse it off in the water and I put oil on the chain. And, you know, I think it is hard on it, but it's amazing that, you know, they last and they can put up with it. You just have to be a good mechanic when you come home and take the bottom bracket and the headset off and things. But I love the biking on the north, on the beach section. But then we got to where Brad did this 90 miles of boating, and we couldn't do that, so we had to do another one of these, you know, 3 miles in a day with our bikes. And again,
carrying a bike through the bush,
it wasn't even really carry, you couldn't carry it, you had to like shove it and take the pedals off, you know, turn the handlebars. Some places we had to like take all the gear off and then throw the bike, you know. It was really, really bad. But then we got into the icy straits. I think that's what they're called. But this tidewater, and we would ride the tide and put our bikes on the boats, and it was really exhilarating. I agree with Brad. That's one of the maybe the best trip in Alaska, I'd say.
And that traverses a lot of the coast of Glacier Bay.
Yeah.
And it's not a part of Glacier Bay many people see. And it's a super spectacular area. So many interesting aspects to it.
Another one of our very early national parks. Well, we are talking today on Outdoor Explorer about the national parks with Roman Dial and Brad Mickeljohn, who have experienced a lot of them in the deep wilderness. And we're going to do that for the rest of the hour. So please stick with us. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we will continue with Outdoor Explorer.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about the national parks in Alaska and the centennial of the national parks. That's kind of our excuse for this conversation, but it's a real thing. The National Park Service started in, I guess, 1916?
August 25th, 1916.
Well, there That's right. And my guest is John Quinley, who is Associate Regional Director for Communications and Operations and kind of a familiar name around Anchorage. He's been working with the Park Service for a long time. So it seems like the Park Service should have been around for more than 100 years because the park seems so eternal, right?
Right.
And it's such a part of our national culture and probably one of the things that every American agrees on, that the national parks are a good thing.
We like to think so, and there clearly is bipartisan support, you know, as you go to Congress. And national parks have been around for more than 100 years. The early parks were, you know, starting in 1872. So it's the National Park Service as an organization to manage them is what's turning 100 this year.
Okay.
And we're looking forward to our second century.
And it's true, parks have been controversial in Alaska, but less and less so, I think.
I think that's true. You know, a lot of the controversy stemmed from the establishment of many of the parks in 1980, and that's just been a long time ago. So for most people who are, you know, certainly 35, 36 years old or even 45 years old, in their minds, really, the national parks in Alaska have always been here.
Yeah.
They've been there their whole life and become more of a part of community life around Alaska and certainly part of the tourism economy as well.
But and they mean something different, I think, in Alaska compared to the rest of the country. We've been talking about that in the rest of the hour, that we have parks that really don't get very many visitors, parks that are really just wilderness and protected land. And then we also have some like Denali and Glacier Bay, which are in Kenai Fjords, which are a key to our whole tourism economy. So we kind of span the whole spectrum as to what the parks are for here.
We do. And those lesser visited parks, while they're lesser visited by traditional visitors, if you will, they're important for subsistence users in rural Alaska, and they're important in preserving these large landscapes that you know, caribou herds, wild salmon depend on to really make Alaska what Alaska is to most people.
Yeah. So what are you guys doing to celebrate your birthday? And it's been going on for a while nationally. I noticed that it got started last year, even though kind of right now at the actual time.
Right. Well, like any good party, it lasted, you know, longer than a day. So we've started off quite some time ago. In terms of events, sort of our signature event for the 25th is going to be at Glacier Bay, the opening of the Huna Tribal House, which is a traditional log building and will be a place for both Huna Tlingit tribal activities, but also for visitors to learn about Native Alaska culture. And also just really a tangible reminder that Glacier Bay is the traditional homeland for the Huna Tlingit, and there's now a permanent place sort of marking that, if you will. We've had other events throughout the year, and also, you know, sort of more programmatic, trying to do some things to expand or increase the relevancy of national parks to a new audience. So one of the things that we're doing not just on the 25th, we've been sort of a regular participant, is the staff at the Public Lands Information Center downtown is going to be over at the farmers market in Mountain View.
Very neat.
And connecting with a community that a lot of folks there have not traditionally visited national parks, certainly didn't grow up visiting national parks because many of them didn't grow up in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I know you and I have talked about some of the sort of the ethnic disparities and so forth, and the issues about to what degree are minorities spending time in the parks and visitation as a whole. But it seems like visitation, at least in Alaska, is pretty healthy in terms of numbers. Lots of people come to our parks.
There are a lot, largely driven by cruise ship traffic, which has been increasing slowly over the years. Nationally, visitation is up as well. Certainly a lot of the sort of the marketing attention around the centennial has something to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
And we suspect that, you know, we'll see continued high numbers in the future as well. But we're also trying to reach new audiences to become park visitors, park supporters in the future.
It seems like the
I think a lot of Alaskans think of some of our big national parks as being for visitors. I mean, everybody goes down to Kenai Fjords now and then, but I mean, we think of sort of Denali, oh, that's for visitors until the fall comes and then we go.
Right. Well, it's, yeah, there is that perception, but people need to remember too that, you know, Denali, while the focus is on the entrance area and the park road, the park is as large as Massachusetts.
Wow.
So
there's plenty of room.
There's a lot of room for Alaskans and visitors, and Denali is not our largest national park. So there's, you know, within the park system in Alaska, there is a lot of space to roam, either as a well-cared for visitor with commercial help taking you around, or on your own and doing it in a self-supporting way.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we encourage a few people to go out and check out their parks for the centennial.
I hope so.
Yeah. Thanks for being with us. John Quinley, Associate Regional Director for Communications and Operations, the National Park Service, Alaska Region. Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. I lay alone in Allen Coast, where only souls I see are ghosts. We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today, the national parks in Alaska. About half of all the national parks, or more than that, are in Alaska, and the really crazy deep wilderness is all in Alaska. And I've got two guests today who have spent a lot of time in that wilderness. Roman Dial, who's a professor at APU, professor of biology and math, but also leads a lot of outdoor trips. And Brad Micklejohn, who is the state director for the Conservation Fund and recent winner of the Murray Award from the Alaska Conservation Foundation. They're also both pack rafting pioneers and involved in the American Pack Rafting Association. We've been going through the parks and talking about some of your adventures, some of which don't sound all that much fun, but still interesting to hear about them. We haven't touched too much on the Arctic parks and your expeditions there. And when I think of some of those places, I think of kind of wet, spongy tundra, which is another kind of terrain that's not that much fun to walk in, though. The Northern Brooks Range, you know, it's super fun to walk through. It's almost like you were saying, walking on a golf course at times where it's nice and dry tundra. What would have been some of your Arctic park experiences you guys have really? Who wants to take that one first?
Well, Brad has been to the Brooks Range like every year for the last 30 years. And, and I just, you know, he's a professional conservationist, and I'm just sort of like a lowly teacher. And
so, you believe that.
So I've only been up there like every other year. Uh-huh. But I really, really like the Gates of the Arctic National Park. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably my favorite park of all. I mean, you know, my son, he was conceived in that park. Peggy and I, when we were like in our early 20s, you know, and she was pregnant with him, we went all the way across the park with a pack raft before people even knew what a pack raft was, the two of us in one boat. So I have really strong emotional memories for that place. And it has like the Arrigetch Peaks. When I was a teenager, I organized an expedition, a month-long expedition, where we went and made first ascents in the Arrigetch Peaks. It's just an amazing place. And it has brush and it has tussocks, but, you know, you learn. And I mean, that's part of what, you know, the mathematical brain side of mine when I'm out in the wilderness, the mathematical brain side of me is always trying to optimize travel and learning where the brush and where the tussocks are and how to avoid them. Now, when I was a young teenager, you know, I stumbled through that stuff just like anybody else. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, when people say, well, isn't there a lot of that? I'm like, you know, I don't know, you know, because as soon as I get into it, and Brad's really good at this too, as soon as we get into it, you know, we find a way out. We're like, oh, you know, it's like an ant, you know, like an ant doesn't get stuck, you know, in a mud puddle. It walks up to the mud puddle and goes, ooh, a mud puddle, I better go around, you know.
I wonder if all our listeners know what tussocks are. They're sort of strange kind of landform where it's kind of marshy and wet, and then you've got these little bowling ball kind of like things that you can kind of can't even walk across.
You can't step on them, and you can't step between them, and you want to just get out of them as soon as you can. So you start to anticipate where they're going to be in flat terrain and where the water's coming down off the hillsides and pooling. So you know, in your planning, as you're looking at maps, you have a good sense of where the areas are that you're going to want to avoid. And when you're out there, you can anticipate that you're going into tussocks and you're going to do all that you can to do an end run around them. You're going to go a lot faster going around them than you're going to go through them.
Yeah,
it's kind of a form of applied ecology, you know. Uh-huh. And tussocks,
what creates them?
Well, they're a sedge, okay, so they're related to grasses, but they have edges on them. And there's a variety of species that create them. And the tussock growth form is a way of elevating the plant's roots and stems out of the cold and wet, because they often grow over permafrost, and that's why there's water puddling up, and that's why they're found in the north. And their elevated position allows them to melt out of the snow earlier so that they can get started growing sooner. Otherwise, they're sort of frozen in the muck. And the older they get, the bigger they are. So we, you know, I mean, it's funny. Like, I talk like, oh, yeah, I never go through brush and I never go through tussocks. Well, of course I do, and I have, like, a whole brush rating system. And I have, like, a way of characterizing. Or it's just, you know, we kind of joke about, oh, yeah, well, we're in the quart size tussocks now. Oh, now we're in the gallon size tussocks. And, right. Oh, now look at that 55-gallon tussock, you know, because they do, they get bigger. And when they're really big, you can kind of step through them.
Are you seeing a lot of change in terms of climate change in those kinds of ecosystems, Brad?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of the tussock habitat is drying up, and you're seeing more brush coming into the tussocks areas. And it's not making them any easier. The kind of the underlying landform is still there. They're still tricky, but tussocks are definitely sort of on their way out in a lot of parts of the state.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe I was just a lot dumber in my, you know, early 20s than I am now, but I do remember a lot more tussocks back then. And I have gone back to many of the same places, and they are drying up.
Stuff's drying up. Yeah, more brush.
It's clear that, you know, the Brooks Range has always been known as the great mecca for tundra hiking. And that may not be true for that much longer. I mean, we're finding places that Roman and I have each hiked in the last 20 or 30 years that are suddenly much brushier. It's just dramatic. I mean, just within a couple of years, the brush is much tougher to get through.
Yeah, interesting. Well, with a warm summer like this, that can only accelerate all those things that are happening, and kind of change your experience of being out there, too, that you don't want to go out in the heat of the day, you know, and it's like super hot and uncomfortable. That's kind of a new thing a little bit, too.
Yep. Yeah, I still refuse to say it's too hot in Alaska. I might say it's so hot, but yeah. I refuse to say it's
too hot.
Then
you get August.
Yeah. Yeah, not too hot now.
You don't complain about June now. It's like, oh, you're missing those days. The monsoons at the state fair must be just around the corner.
So let's take that opportunity to talk about change in the parks, because the parks, national parks, are not like unchanging monuments. There are things that in ecology is always in an arrow. It's never staying the same. It's always new. And part of that ecology is the human usage, which is, I think, a lot more. And I think there are more young people who are doing more adventurous things than ever before. What kinds of change? I mean, we mentioned some of the climate change effects with brush. What are some other changes you guys have seen in the parks over the years?
Well, there's a lot more pack rafts than there ever were. You know, I mean, in the 80s,
there
were
places that nobody ever went, now they go.
Right, yeah. I mean, people do, like that Nabesden and McCarthy, I mean, the only people who did that, you know, in the 80s were the people in the Wilderness Classic. And now people come from around the world to do that trip, and they all have pack rafts. Europeans are flocking to the Brooks Range. I remember, like, Dick Griffith was probably the first one to traverse the Brooks Range, and he did it in two segments that took him, you know, 30 years apart to finish, or 20 years, something like that. And then there was another guy from Anaktuvuk Pass whose name escapes me, and he did the whole Brooks Range over, you know, like a 30-year period from the Mackenzie River all the way to Point Hope. And then I was the
first.
When
you call it traverse, you're talking about an east-west traverse.
Yeah, east-west.
Crossing it. Right.
Exactly. And then I think I may have been the first one to do it within a season, other than Native people, you know, but who I was the first one to do it recreationally. I did it in 1 year or 60 days. But now, and then, you know, nobody, I mean, you could get a National Geographic magazine for traversing it from east to west. And now, you know, couples do it before they settle down to have kids and get married. And recently an Australian, he went all the way from, like, the Canadian border to Kotzebue, I think, in 30 days, you know?
Wow.
And a young woman.
That's intense, isn't it?
It's really intense. Yeah, I was in contact with him, and he hurt himself. And the only way, it sounds kind of silly, but the only way he could deal with his pain was to hustle faster. Because every time he stopped, he couldn't get going again, so he just never stopped.
Wow.
And then a young woman, I'm not sure what her name is, recently solo traversed the whole Brooks Range with, you know, a pack raft. And I'm not sure how long it took her, but it's become, you know, it's become a destination. And yeah. this Lost Coast.
But I mean, still for really, really hardy people.
And I think it's a good thing. I mean, the use is still relatively small. I think the use in Yakchak has gone from 100 people a year to 200 people a year, largely thanks to pack rafters. But it's a you know just a tiny level of use.
Yeah.
It's not a problem. And I think getting people out into wild country has a really great conservation benefit. It makes people care about these places. I mean, I think Alaska's greatest treasures are national parklands. I mean, it's something that we really should be incredibly proud of. And you saw that, you know, with Anilka when Carter was vilified for locking up all these federal lands. You know, a town like Seward was up in arms that the park that Kenai Fjords was suddenly blocked off, and it was going
to be the death of the
economy of Seward.
And now,
I mean, you couldn't pry that out of their cold dead hands to take Kenai Fjords away from them. I mean, I think they recognized that that was a really great thing, and it took a lot of vision, took a lot of courage to push these things through. But it's that same fight that you go through in conservation, no matter where you are. It's from Acadia to Gates of the Arctic. You know, everyone thinks it's going to be the death of the economy. It ends up being, you know, a really great boon.
Well, as a conservationist, are there issues related to use that concern you at all in Alaska?
You know, I'd like to see people get out of their cars and get farther out into the parks. I mean, I think that would be a good thing for all of us. I think there'd be a lot of health benefits from it.
But there's no threat to the park as far as you're concerned.
I don't think so. You know, one of the things that I would like to see the Park Service do is exercise restraint. You know, our parks are pretty special. And one of the special attributes of our parks is the wilderness character. And it's difficult for the land managers to not actively manage. They want to go in and do things. And they want to put in weather stations, they want to put in webcams, they want to collar the animals. And I think exercising restraint is a hard thing for some managers to get their heads around. And I would encourage them to do that.
Yeah. Well, and wildlife management has been such a big issue, especially with wildlife management on the borders of parks. And of course, Anilka didn't necessarily stop hunting and the kinds of traditional uses in parks. So we don't have all like non-hunting parks like they do in the Lower 48.
Mm-hmm. Well, much of Denali, the old parks,
prior existing ones. Yeah.
You know, I'd also like to see the land managers encourage this kind of wilderness travel. You know, I did a long traverse through Gates of the Arctic a couple of years ago, and it was a 3-week trip. And I gave a talk about it, and some of the Park Service people were at that talk, and they said, "Well, how did you do that?" Carrying bear barrels. And the fact of the matter is I didn't take bear barrels. I couldn't have taken bear barrels to do that trip. For a 3-week trip, it's not possible.
Right.
And so, you know, I probably will get in trouble for admitting that I didn't have bear barrels. But, you know, I think you have to exercise a certain amount of latitude to encourage people to get out and have these real wilderness experiences and not kind of bring our Great Smokies National Park mentality or Yosemite mentality or Yellowstone mentality that really doesn't fit here in Alaska. I know Roman and I have each had our run-ins with the Park Service here. We love the parks. We have challenges with the Park Service. And kind of, you know, bringing an Alaska appropriate mentality to the managing of this parks is...
I wonder if the way you bring that up sparked a thought in my head. I wrote a book about the national parks all over the country, and there's such a culture clash if you've grown up in Alaska to go to the parks outside.
I can't stand to go to the parks
outside. There's signs everywhere. I mean, like, you'd be standing at the top of Yosemite Valley at top of a 3,000-foot cliff, and there'll be a sign that says, you know, don't stand too close to the cliff.
I mean, call it the land of no. It's the land of no. I mean, you go to California, it's the land of no.
Things you think you never have to tell anybody, but you talk to the Park Service people there, and they say, well, we had somebody fall in the Grand Canyon yesterday because they were walked over it while they had their face in a camera, you know. So people do really stupid stuff. But then when those personnel get transferred to Alaska, maybe they bring along some of that aspect where they're trying to stop people from thinking of it as Disneyland. I don't know. What do you think, Roman?
I think every land manager in Alaska should read Joseph Sack's Mountains Without Handrails to see, you know, this is really part of our heritage as Americans to maintain wilderness where you can go out and do something crazy and stupid without somebody telling you not to. Mm-hmm. I don't think we need permits to go into our public lands when there's really no resource damage happening. And on the flip side, I don't think the Park Service should even build roads close to these wilderness parks. They should keep them the way they are and keep the visitor centers out of them and keep access out. I think, honestly, they should not allow airplanes in. You know, like, no airplanes. And I know there's a lot of people out there who are like, what? No, I need to fly around. Look at them. Well, And honestly, when I was 18,
so like, like Wrangell St. Elias, you'd say like those air services in McCarthy should just shut down.
Well, I mean, I'm looking ahead. Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, I love pilots and I like flying a little bit, you know. But I have always tried to do my big wilderness traverses using not chartered flights, but you know, scheduled flights to villages. So I go from one village to another, or from one road to another, and I don't really feel like the airplane is necessary, especially with pack rafts. In fact, this really kind of, you know, Brad is much more measured than I am, and I can get worked up really easily over this sort of thing. And in Yellowstone, you know, the American Pack Rafting Association, we've been trying to get pack rafts or boats of any kind to be allowed on Yellowstone's rivers and streams, and we've been stopped in our tracks by sort of, you know, traditional users there, fishermen primarily, who say, no, they don't belong in the Yellowstone. Well, these very same fishermen feel it's perfectly fine to fly in an airplane into real wilderness in Alaska, and the airplane kills wilderness dead. You know, like it's a saying, you know, fly an hour or walk a week. Well, walk a week, buddy. Walk a week to your steelhead fishing, and then you'll really see what wilderness is. Don't fly in.
Yeah, the provision in ANILCA that kind of grandfathered in airplanes was a major compromise. It's, you know, to have the best wilderness in the world sort of violated by airplanes is a contradiction that's hard to stomach. And I'd love to see that changed.
Interesting. Outdoor Explorer, I'm Charles Wolforth. We are talking about the national parks on their anniversary with a couple of, you might call, national park extremists.
Maybe wilderness extremists.
There you go. Roman Dial, who's a professor at APU, and Brad Micklejohn, who's a conservationist with the Conservation Fund. I feel like we might have missed some parks in terms of like our statewide travel around. We talked a little bit about Glacier Bay.
We should have talked about our traverse of Sitka Historic National Park. I think that was, 15 minutes? That was record time crossing that unit. It's a relatively small one in Sitka.
I think that it's, a great spot. I just had a really fun time in Sitka this summer. And there's a place for just sort of, you know, an older person or a young person walking through those big trees in this little tiny park and thinking, oh, wow, this is what it's like. And so both are really important, you know, having that sort of that introductory experience, because 99.99% of Americans are not going to have these kinds of experiences you're talking about. I mean, they're simply not, and they can't.
Right. It's that combination of, you know, making places accessible and then maintaining that wilderness aspect. I think you need to have both. And I think a place like Denali is a good example. I mean, it's well managed there. People stay, you know, in the buses, on the road, and it's probably good for the wildlife, and it leaves a lot of wild country for the rest of us.
Well, this is one of the things I've often thought is going to Yellowstone. They say that more than 99% of the people never go more than a quarter mile from the road. Mm-hmm. So if you're on the road, there's a heck of a lot of people around. But you hike 3 or 4 miles off, and it's not maybe like Alaska, but it's maybe like Chugach State Park. I mean, you can hike all day and see hardly anybody there. And so on one hand, you say, well, it's a shame that all those people are crowded together. On the other hand, the fact that they're crowded together allows us to go out and not be crowded because, you know, we haven't spread everybody equally. So
you've probably read the book Land Gone Lonesome, Dan O'Neill's book, author of Firecracker Boys. It's about
I've never heard of that one.
He floats from Whitehorse, actually Dawson City, down the Yukon to Circle. And it's sort of a recap of McPhee's book, Coming Into the Country. And what's amazing is the amount of change that's happened on Yukon River with the number of people living there. Mm-hmm. I think when McPhee went down, there were several hundred people living on the Yukon River. Now there's only one person. Mm-hmm. And through active management, the Park Service has removed people from Yukon Charlie Preserve. And I think there's a cost to all of us in that. It's kind of been a deliberate management strategy to take people out of a park, and I'm not sure it's the right move.
I'm sure that's true about the park. It's also true in the Alaska bush in general, and that because airplane travel is so much more expensive than it was in the 70s, there's a lot less people living out there in a lot of places where people homesteaded or had their spot that they don't go to anymore because it's too hard to get there.
You've been through Yukon, Charlie. You should talk about some of your trips there.
How did you do it?
Well, you know, my first time I flew in with a helicopter right to the border because I was staking mining claims, and we staked them faster than they anticipated, so as a bonus, they flew us to the edge of the park, and I was with this guy Jim Boffman, and he ordered his pack raft like on the phone from Beaver Sports, and it was delivered to Eagle. And he'd only been in a pack raft. This is back in the old days with open boats, and he'd only been in a pack raft once in McGrath. And we hiked into high water Charlie River right from the border of the park, and then floated the Charlie and the Yukon in an open boat. And it was a real adventure. I mean, it was like, you know, we tore a boat open, you know, the boats were always filled with water. We just had rain gear and no PFDs and no helmets.
It was, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was like really bad, but I mean, bad style, but it was great adventure. And I would hate it if the Park Service wouldn't let fools like us do things like that.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I mean, there's an aspect of this that is not knowing what's going to happen, right? I mean, that's sort of the essence of adventure, is you go into something and you sort of prepare, but you really don't know what's going to happen. And it's like up on, it's on you.
Yeah, and then it activates a bunch of parts of your brain that don't get activated back home. But but it was a wonderful trip. And I, you know, I lived in the interior for 10 years, so I really like the interior. I like the rounded hills. I like the kind of the somber spruce. You know, I like the understated beauty of it. You know, it's kind of subtle as opposed to like in your face, you know, Wrangell St. Elias or Denali's, Ruth Gorge. You know, it's a little more low-key. And you know, it's just like when you see a canyon in the interior with dull sheep swimming the river and running off into the woods. I mean, you just don't see that anywhere else. And that was amazing to us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I like the interior a lot. This Kobuk trip we did recently where we walked from the Noatak and then pack rafted down the Salmon. And then what was the name of that river we hiked over to after the Salmon? The Tuxuk or?
Tuxuk, yeah.
Tuxuk, yeah. And floated down that to the Kobuk. And then Brad had this brilliant idea that we should walk up the Kobuk. And it really was brilliant. The walking along the Kobuk, there's like an animal trail there. We could have ridden fat bikes. And we walked for a day up the Kobuk to the great Kobuk sand dunes.
Oh, yeah.
And that was really
neat. What was that like? I've always wondered what that's like, the sand dunes.
Well, they're kind of, they remind me of other sand dunes around the state, you know, like the Bremner Dunes. And then there's a bunch of dunes just south of Delta along the Delta River. And they're kind of they're not like the dunes in the lower 48. They're kind of a, it's sand from gravels. I mean, sand from glaciers. Mm-hmm. And so
pretty coarse.
Well, it's very firm. It's great walking. Mm-hmm. And the vegetation that grows along the side is kind of the same in all these dune areas.
What keeps it a dune rather than being overcome by vegetation?
Well, parts of it are. Parts of it are getting vegetated from the sides, and it's always kind of shifting as the sand moves around.
Right. It's sort of a disturbance that kills the plants as it buries them.
Somewhat similar to like a Kincaid Park where you've got this land that sort of obviously was a dune, and then you go to a certain area and it still is a dune.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's really neat, and some Anchorage folks, they flew into Kobuk Dunes pretty much about the same time we were with their fat bikes and rode around the dunes for 5 days with their fat bikes. But then we floated down the Kobuk back to Kiana. And I guess what I wanted to say about the Kobuk area and what made it really amazing to me is how rich it is. I mean, it has salmon run up it. There's that Western Arctic caribou herd that crosses it both in the fall and the spring. And there's waterfowl. And it's just incredibly rich. And you can see why there's so many you know, Inupiaq communities that are on that river, and so many people who still live a subsistence lifestyle. I mean, we saw remnants of old houses, you know, from, you know, pre-European times. It just was an amazingly rich place. It's the richest interior type climate. It's right where the interior and the Arctic kind of meet. Mm-hmm. It feels really interior, but you can see the Arctic from there, you know, and I just thought it was an amazing place.
Not many trees.
No, it's actually forested. And, you know, it's not as visually striking. You're kind of thinking, you know, when am I going to see the big dramatic spires of Gates of the Arctic? And there's nothing like that that's, you know, kind of immediately captivating, but it's a subtle beauty. It's a, you know, it's this large, intact ecosystem. Hmm. And it's been inhabited for thousands of years. It's quite striking that
way. Lots of villages, so you can, like, start and end a float trip in a lot of different ways.
You can, yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was spectacular. And, again, it's one that's been on my list. And we just went there, I guess, in June. And, you know, I think Brad and I, I'm trying to talk Brad into going this month to Bering Land Bridge and walk from Deering to Nome.
And I have the impression, again, that's one of the very little visited park units, that it's really there because of the geography. And I think Ted Stevens wanted to have a cross-border park that kind of never took off. Is there anything there? I mean...
Oh, there's absolutely nothing there, Charles. Yeah. That's what makes it so fascinating. No one would ever want to go there. But there's a lot of great prehistory. I mean, the whole, you know, Bering-Lambridge story is fascinating.
Plus there's all that really cool lava stuff. There's like lava fields and Imerik Lake, which is like a lava lake. And there was a guy who walked from Mexico all the way to the tip of the Seward Peninsula, Peter Vacco. And that was his favorite walking, was on the Seward Peninsula on the Continental Divide. He also liked the Western Brooks Range. In fact, he went back to cross the Brooks Range. Just think about that. Here's a guy who goes all the way from Mexico to the tip of Alaska and says the Bering-Lambridge area was some of the best walking he
encountered. Yeah, because he was almost done. That's right. He's going to get his cheeseburger.
Heading for the barn, that's right.
So we've got a few minutes left, Brad, and I know you're a conservationist and do a lot of work with the Conservation Fund. 100 years of the national parks. When you think about our parks in another century, how do you envision them? I mean, I bet they'll be a lot different in terms of the ecology.
Yeah, I think what we're going to see is they're going to become islands. I mean, right now our parks are kind of part of a wildlands matrix because the surrounding lands are also wild. It's state land, it's BLM land, it's, you know, Native Corporation land. But in 100 years, that's going to be quite different. So we're going to find out whether our parks really are big enough to maintain the ecological elements that they were designed for. I mean, I think they went big and they got it right, but we're going to find out. They're going to be become increasingly surrounded by a developed land.
Yeah. I wonder about the outdoors experience, how that may change. I mean, you were mentioning how it has changed in technology. You've already mentioned fat tire bikes and pack rafts. You know, it's a lot of this technology makes it a lot easier for a lot more people to do things, which is a good thing, right?
Well, in some ways, yeah. It increases the value of wildlands. I have a slightly darker view than Brad, though. I sort of have the sensation that there's a movement to keep people out of wilderness and to separate nature and humanity more fully. Mm-hmm. And I have the sense that there is a movement of people out there who would like to keep people out of national parks and wilderness areas 100%, and that the only way we'll actually be able to visit them is to sort of reserve your drone flight, where you can fly a drone across the park and watch it on your computer screen. And I know that sounds, you know, like, Roman, nobody will ever do that. I don't know. People are really glued to their devices now.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the Pokemon Go craze, right?
So it almost seems like there's this cultural divide that is getting more and more intense between those who are more deeply into wilderness experience than ever before and doing more adventurous stuff, and that, you know, especially in the younger generation who feel that as their defining characteristic, and others who never go outside at all, right?
Yeah.
And that, you know, never the twain shall meet, it seems, in some way, which is interesting to imagine what that's going to be like in the future.
Yeah, I think the risk is that people are going to stop going, or they're not going to be able to go. They're not going to be allowed to go.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, right now the level of use is so minimal. There's no impact from the kind of use that, you know, Roman and I and our like are imposing on the land. It's it's really nothing.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I guess we won't be around in 100 years.
So. That'll be somebody else's problem.
Yeah, but we'll just hopefully say we did our best. Well, I thank you both. This has been fascinating. I've really enjoyed it. My guests have been Roman Dial, who's an APU professor, an adventurer, has done all kinds of stuff all over the world, and Brad Mickleton, who's the state director of the Conservation Fund, and as you've heard, they've done a ton of adventures together. Our producer is Eric Bork. My name is Charles Wolforth. Please join me again next week for Outdoor Explorer. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.